Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 7th of October, Anno Domini 2017, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Here comes the news. On Wednesday, Google announced a bucket load of new hardware. Like the Apple event that went before it, it was a lot of the same old stuff beefed up and one really nice new thing. They dropped two phones, two smart speakers, a new laptop, smart earbuds that instantly translate words into your language, a camera that takes its own pictures, and a revamped VR headset. The two phones are, unsurprisingly, the Pixel 2 and the Pixel 2 XL. They are exactly what you'd expect a pair of high-powered phones to be in 2017. What seems more fascinating is how Google's Android smartphones is how good Android smartphones can be because of how much control the company has over the process now, just like Apple always has had. The ubiquitous Snapdragon 835 chipset, 4 gig of RAM, along with the bloatware-free version of Android 8.0 make the thing crazy fast. Both are shockingly light, and both of their coated aluminum bodies look and feel more premium than you'd expect. Both phones, my daughter's already announced she wants a Pixel 2. I told her, you're an adult now, go for it. Both phones.
But Dad!
No, dead silence on the other end of the line. Both phones, I don't know what she thinks, how much money she thinks I have.
No, you better be worried.
Yeah?
Because her not saying anything.
Yeah.
Mine. Just turning
and turning. Yeah, I love
my
daughter.
Hey, Mom, would Dad buy me a phone, please?
Yeah, right. That'll be next. Both phones also have Google's Active Edge, which is suspiciously similar to HTC's own Edge Sense. In any case, squeezing the bottom half of the phone launches Google Assistant, which then starts listening for your commands. Google also announced the Pixel Book with Chrome OS. The outside uses the same design motif as the back of the Pixel smartphones with an aluminum and glass design that feels extremely solid. The keyboard is similarly excellent. Keys are nice and large. Speaking of the keyboard, Google has put in some new special keys. There's now a dedicated button for the Assistant in the same spot you'd find the Windows key on a Windows laptop, and there's a button. There are buttons for taking screenshots and pulling up the menu settings in the function row. Of course, it's a 12.3-inch touchscreen that rotates all the way around to make it a tablet. It only weighs 2.2 pounds. The $1,000 model gets you a Core i5 processor with 8 gig of RAM and 128 gig of storage, but you can step up to 256 gig for $1,200, and an i7 model with 16 gig of RAM and 512 gig of storage is a mere $1,650. The Pixelbook Pen stylus is only a paltry $100 more. Google Clips is a $250 AI-powered little camera that creepily makes its own decisions on what to record. No thanks. They've added a couple of new smart speakers to the original Google Home. The Home Max is a $400 big speaker with lush sound, and the Home Mini is a $50 gadget that compares to the Echo Amazon Echo Dot. The really nifty news is the $160 Pixel Buds, Bluetooth earbuds, that are necessary because the new phones have no headphone jack. I'm looking at you, Apple. But the truly jaw-dropping part is real-time translation, so you can have a conversation with someone who speaks any one of 40 foreign languages. There's a tiny delay as the translation takes place, but nothing that gets in the way of conversing.
Don't wait for the translation. Answer the question.
You're right. So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Google's hardware event 2017. And your choices are, I want it all. Some of it looks really interesting. Meh. And goo-hoo now? So far, we've got 25 votes and meh is pretty much in the lead. But I know you'll have more to say, so if you scroll down on the right, under Fascinating Stuff, you'll see the forums. The second forum down is the poll discussion. And so far, at least the first item in the poll discussion is 7 October 17, Google's Hardware Event 2017. Feel free to put posts in there all week long. But in the meantime, of course, if you want to talk about this or dang near anything, give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free at 1-800-790-0415.
It's interesting. They had their Google I.O. event earlier this year and talked all about the software. Now they're having a hardware event. And so they're kind of going like some of the other companies do to have two big meetings a year.
Right.
The danger of that is consumers then become trained to wait until then. So in the Apple iPhone world, we know there's a new iPhone coming in September.
Right.
So, you know, if you're October or October, you buy one. If you're August, maybe I'll wait a month.
Right.
And that's got to hurt Apple's bottom line with people waiting to see.
Right. And, of course, Apple has been selling so many or managing production in such a way that there's always backlog, so they're not selling as many as they could be selling. Google I.O. is about Google's new concept stuff and software, and then this is the Google hardware event, and this is where they actually announce stuff.
Well, this is the one thing that I liked about my Pixel phone.
Yeah.
When I first got it. It didn't come with all that bloatware.
Right.
It literally was stripped down. It wasn't all this other stuff. Well, that's built into the phone. No. This came, like I say, other than Google Chrome and the mail, that was the only thing. All the rest of the stuff I had to add on that I wanted, you know, all the other reminder notes and any other software, I had to install it.
Yep.
Because it's very clean and smooth.
Yep.
I love it.
And that's a beautiful thing. You can, on many of these things, you can disable mm-hmm. some of the bloatware, but not all of it. And it's just, and it doesn't go away. I mean, it's still in the phone. It's taking up space and it's annoying. The Pixel 2 and the Pixel 2 XL. Two things I don't like about them. You can't remove the battery and, they have no headphone jack. But other than that, I like,
doesn't have a headphone jack?
Nope. Not anymore. Nobody's got them anymore. Apple took them away. So everybody took them away.
There was a Motorola one that did it first. But no one remembers that.
Right. My point. Thank you.
Yeah. Hmm. And how much is the Pixel 2? $1,000?
Yes.
The internet doesn't seem to care when the Google releases a $1,000 phone, but when Apple released a $1,000 phone, it was all over.
Well, and here's the reason. Because when Google does it, we think of it as a prototype.
Ah.
Right? Because that's what the Pixel Chromebook was. And now the new Pixel Book.
Yeah.
Google doesn't expect to sell a lot of them. They expect them to be what everybody else uses as the gold standard when they create the next generation of Chromebooks or phones.
Yep.
Whereas, in fact, Apple is the only game in town. So if they put out, if Google puts out a $1,000 phone, you can wait 6 months and buy one from Motorola for $800 or $700.
Yeah, Samsung or anybody. Any other vendors are going to be copying.
Whereas with Apple, it's $1,000 or no dollars. Those are your choices.
It's either this
or it's really a different deal.
And all the big Android carriers have their flagship phones in that $1,000 mark, but then they always make cheaper phones too.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So
they've got to cover their bases because not everybody's going to go for the $1,000 phone.
Yep. Yep.
There's a lot of phones.
I'm building one at Google. It's $949 or $39 a month.
Well, and
I can do $39 a month.
That's exactly right.
I was so surprised.
But they don't say that's just for the phone.
Right.
The service is on top of that.
Right. Of course it is.
I was surprised at work. I saw a couple folks because I was telling them, you know, we use this one app for work. And I said, well, put it on your phone. And they go, they pull out their phones, and they're still the old flip phones.
Flip phones.
And it's like, whoa.
Nothing better than an old flip phone, I'm telling you. No butt dialing, ever.
It was good enough for Captain Kirk.
It was good enough for Captain Kirk. And you can slam it shut, which at least gives you sort of the feeling of slamming the receiver down.
Yep.
You know, so you get a little something out of it that way.
Yeah, satisfaction that way.
But the thing I really, really was impressed by was the earbuds, whatever they're calling them. I don't remember, something buds. But the basic idea is they're standard Bluetooth headset, right? So you can use it with the phone.
Mm-hmm.
But they will also do real-time translation.
Pixel buds.
From Pixel buds, of course they are. From one language to another. So if you only spoke German,
mm-hmm.
and I only speak English and we wanted to talk to each other, we could use these. And they will hear in German
and translate
to English. And
the English will go to German.
And the English will go to German. So if you've both got the headsets on, you can converse with anybody in up to 40 languages, which is not a bad number.
No.
It's an interesting idea, and they've done a really nice job. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be instant translation, but the lag is very, very short. And I'm sure the translation is not perfect, but if you don't speak the language, it's better than nothing.
Yeah, it's better than poking the eye with a sharp stick.
Exactly right. So I'm actually very, very impressed by those.
And so all the people that have been using Google Translate for all these years is where a lot of this language translation is coming from. And there's an option when it translates something for you that you can give a better translation.
Yep.
And so it just keeps getting better and better. What was the old one? The Google 411.
Yeah.
Was just to do voice recognition. And then once they got all that voice data, they canceled that service because they didn't really care about the information service. They wanted all the voice recognition data.
Right. And then when they first brought out voice translation for voicemail,
yep.
the voicemail to text, you got to correct it. And so they had millions of people crowdsourced teaching their AI. And that's the big thing that Apple brought out this week, is not all these pieces of hardware.
Google.
But Google. What did I say?
Apple.
and Apple didn't bring out it at all, but Google brought out not just all this hardware, but more importantly, the AI behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Google Assistant is just getting smarter and smarter.
Well, look at how far we've come. Let's face it. You know, from when I can remember, what was it, Speak and Dictate, or, you know. Dragon Naturally Speaking. That wasn't that long ago.
And it was really expensive and needed a huge power computer.
And it was really affected on whether you were talking, you know, or didn't have a cold.
Right. Because
if you had a cold, it couldn't recognize you for love nor money. And how far things have come now that, you know.
This is so amazing. I can actually dictate text to Google Docs
mm-hmm.
in my browser and have it type it out for me.
Well, for my watches, you can sit there and Google a text.
Yeah.
And send it.
I can send somebody a text from my watch.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I do.
And I do it all the time when I'm driving.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, and it's easy and it's convenient, but more importantly, the stuff you can ask Google and the stuff that you can get it to translate, and the stuff that you can get it to do for you. This camera, which creeps me out, by the way. The camera will decide what's interesting and take pictures for you. It holds 16 gig of audio, of video, and then you plug it into your phone and download it. Well, that's exactly it. It uses the
it has a billion mundane photos in Google Photos.
Right,
and it knows what mundane is versus popular.
Exactly, and so if you've got, for example, they show dogs and kids and all this other stuff. I'm waiting for the first time somebody sticks it in a dressing room or whatever, and yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the concept, in terms of this thing is smart enough to know over time what's interesting to you. Is fascinating in terms of AI.
And it probably is looking at your Google Photos and
yep.
seeing what you've taken pictures of before.
Yep. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, Andy from Greece is patiently waiting on the line. And we'll be back in just a few minutes with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites. It's 19 minutes after the hour. We'll see you in a couple.
online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Andy from Greece on the line. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hey, Nick. Just a real quick thing. While that whole thing on the Alzheimer's radio program was playing, I could hear your voices in the background.
Oh,
I have mic in there someplace, or it's bleeding through.
Yep, thanks.
Just to let you know.
Are you listening on the air or on the stream or on...
On the phone, because I turned off the radio, because you're not supposed to have radio on when you're listening on the phone.
Right. Good job.
See, I'm trainable.
Apparently you are, yes.
The Pixel Buds.
Yeah.
Is the translation actually happening in the earbud, or is it in the phone and...
Oh, I'm sure it's actually happening in the phone. It's actually probably happening in the cloud. So the earbuds are connected to your phone, and the phone is connected to the cloud, and the knee bone's connected to the thigh bone, and...
Yeah, I was reading that footnote. There's little footnote one on that translate thing, and you have to have the Android Assistant on the phone, so it's not all phones have Android Assistant, and it has to be turned on. You have to have the data plan, and yeah, so it looks like it's not even doing it on the phone; it's doing it on the cloud,
right?
Which would explain the slight delay.
Yeah,
right.
Okay,
but the fact that it can do it at all is a pretty amazing thing.
Well, yeah, and because the file, if it weren't doing it up in the cloud, would be your basic. Like you joked Thursday night, it's not a cup, it's a coffee urn, you know.
Exactly.
But,
I swear, I only have one cup a day.
Right.
Yeah, really.
A cup takes 3 gallons, but it's a cup.
There you go. Thunderbird question for you.
Yeah.
My Thunderbird is still set up to do pop mail. And I get, periodically, I get a message that says it wants to compact the file.
Uh-huh.
What's it doing when it does that?
Basically,
just like the old defrag?
No, not quite. It's basically getting rid of spaces. Here's the thing: when you download, as you know, broadly speaking, IMAP keeps the mail up on the server so you can get it from any device. POP brings it down to your machine, so it's only available on that device.
Mm-hmm.
But in doing so, it gets a little sloppy. If you erase something, there's open space, and it's got some things that it uses for scratch pad areas and stuff like that. When you compress the file, it takes all that open space away and makes the file as small as possible without a lot of... You know, if I download 40 messages and I delete 30 of them, that space is still in that file.
Mm.
They're just actually marked for removal. They're still there. They're just marked for removal. So when you do a compression, it actually removes them and makes the file much smaller.
And if a folder gets over 4 gigabytes, it will do the warning message and ask if you want to compact
right.
it.
Okay. All right. So it's not like it's compressing it like a zip file or anything like that. It's just getting rid of the space that you don't need.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. All righty.
All right.
Thank you very much. That was an easy one this week. Thank you
very
much.
It was good. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We do recommend that people do, where possible, that people do IMAP, because IMAP does keep the mail up at the server, which means that if you have multiple devices, and so many of us do nowadays, that you can get the same mail on every device.
And one device knows when you delete it on another device. We get a lot of customers will come in and say, I have to delete my 1,000 spam messages on my phone, and then when I get to the computer, I've got to delete them again. And says, yeah, that's how POP works. We joke that POP is an old standard. It's about 40 years old, and it was designed when having a computer at all was such a novelty and
right.
expensive, no one did. And so you dial into the internet on your modem, download all the mail and hung up as soon as you could because you had to pay by the minute.
Also, internet service providers preferred POP because it meant they weren't handling your mail for very long.
And IMAP is a newer standard. It's, what, about 35 years old?
You're right.
where
it's the new kid on the block.
Yeah, your mail stays on the server, and each device looks at the mail, so the server is sort of the master. So when you delete a message on one device, it's deleted from the server, which then synchronizes to your other devices.
Right.
Here in town, Roadrunner email would almost always set up as POP because Roadrunner didn't support IMAP.
Right.
However, somewhere along the way, Time Warner started supporting IMAP, where Roadrunner didn't.
Right.
Which doesn't make any sense because it's the same company.
Well,
so yeah. you could switch your mail server. So instead, in fact, you can still do this now. If you're using pop-server.rochester.art.com, you can make a new mail account and use mail.twc.com with IMAP. And that will let you synchronize the mail between all your devices. So each of your devices will use IMAP. On the iPhone and iPad, if you set up a new account now, it knows to use IMAP. With Google, it uses IMAP. With Yahoo, it uses IMAP. I assume Android probably works the same way.
Very much so.
In the olden days, you used to have to know your mail server addresses to put them in there. And now the companies pretty much know all the major carriers.
The major carriers,
every
yeah.
now and then we'll run into a small, you know, local ISP that it doesn't know. And then it's almost always mail.isp.com.
Often it is. But it, for example, with a lot of people who have their own domains,
yep.
You have to do whatever your company says. Like I have a number of my domains are Bluehost, and so it'll be box something.
Right.
.bluehost.com.
And they spread that out so everyone's not on one server.
Right.
Yeah.
You get better service because they have fewer people on each server, and they're all virtual servers, so it's, you know, but
yeah.
they're spread out, and the big thing is you have to know that address. Now, it's not magic. They tell you. If you go look at the system, they'll tell you what to use in your mail, but they'll let you do POP, they'll let you do IMAP, they'll let you do whatever you want to do with it. So very nice ability, having the ability to choose between POP and IMAP, but IMAP is superior for people who have multiple devices.
Now, Google has an interesting feature that we ran into a problem this week with a customer who only had 128 gig storage on their device. Google has something called All Mail. And so you're probably used to the inbox, which is where your mail comes in. And then you've got your sent mail and your deleted mail. Well, Google has this all mailbox, which is all your mail.
Yep.
Everything received, everything sent, everything deleted. It's all your mail. And then they have another mailbox called important, where it tries to figure out what you think is important. So if you have those turned on your computer, your inbox, in essence, gets duplicated in the all folder and pretty much duplicated in the important folder. So this one customer this week had 70 gigabytes of Google Mail on her computer.
Right.
Because of these other folders. You can turn off the all mail folder and the important folder for IMAP services, and I'm going to post a link on how to do that, so they don't download to your computer. Because for a lot of times it just confuses people. They look in the inbox, and there's your mail. You look in all mail, and there's your mail.
It's in there, too.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. But, and this all comes from the fact that at one point, when Google first brought out Gmail, and the same thing when they brought out Google Drive, there were no folders or the ability to segregate things into things into stuff. It was just all flat your mail.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because everybody at Google uses search. So if I want to find the latest message from Dave, mm-hmm. I would search for and write and sort it by date. Well, that makes sense to people who do Google all day long
mm-hmm.
at Google.
Right. On the website.
Right. Yeah. And it doesn't make sense for regular human beings who are used to having multiple folders they can put mail into so they can just go look at that mail
mm-hmm.
Without having to then twice think about, okay, I've got to, this is my filter.
Yep.
Well, that's one thing. No, as I told you, you know, I got to put together a new box. One of the nice things
there will be a computer in that box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully. But the one thing, one less worry that I have is backing up any of the documents. I don't have to worry about my mail, any of my bookmarks, because I use Chrome. So all I have to do is reinstall Chrome on this thing. and boom, everything is there. My photos, my emails, all my contacts, everything is there. And I don't have to worry about, oh, yeah, I got to back up this one. Because back in the old days, you had to sit there and back up with Thunderbird, you had to back up all those other folders and then put them back into that buried in subdirectory and everything else. And you don't have to do that anymore.
Right. The only, and I was talking to somebody about this and they were saying, well, I don't even know why the new Chromebook has 256 gig or 512 gig because everything lives in the cloud. I said, well, yeah, except for Android apps.
Yep.
Once Android apps are available, you're going to want to load them on your machine.
And just the apps right now that you can get just off the Google Store.
Many of them live in the cloud.
Yeah. Yep.
And on the off chance you don't have internet access, it is still nice to be able to see your list of messages and be able to reply to something.
Mm-hmm.
It'll wait in the outbox until you get internet, but it's nice to have that option.
Right. So yep. the ability to put everything in the cloud means you don't need a lot of storage, but now that Google is adding Android apps, you do need a lot of storage. So,
and you know, this just throws me back to one other thing. You know, going back and talking about old times, you know, like the voice recognition and all that. Going back to the old dial-up days.
Oh, yeah.
Where you would sit there and quick download your emails, log off. And because that was time and money. You would go ahead and write all your responses, log back into your internet service, and then send your emails back up.
And then more would come in, and you'd have to answer them, and it was an unending cycle.
Oh, yeah.
It was an unending cycle. That's absolutely true.
But compared to nowadays.
Mom, Dad forgot to go to bed again. Yep.
Yeah.
Dave Enright. Dave Enright, ladies and gentlemen.
I'll never live that one down.
No, you never will.
As long as I live.
I got that call. You.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All righty. Were you up all night, were you?
God bless y'all.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, and I remember, what are these, Blue Wave was the name of the software on the old Frog Pond BBS?
Well, they all had them, though, but, I mean, you had different ones, FidoNet and everything else, where you log in, and you would download all your mail, because it was just the way you did it, and respond, and then put it back up, and like Steve said, then you'd have others, mm-hmm. and that's just the way you did it.
Your offline mail reader.
I remember the phone number for the Frog Pond. It was 271-766. What?
Because that's probably been assigned to somebody new now.
Well, it's okay. But the reason I remember it is because it's spelled BS1 Pond.
Nice.
You know what? Probably not, because most folks don't use landlines anymore.
Yeah, not a lot of...
It's all cell phones.
Right. 271 is not a cell phone exchange. At least it wasn't.
Yeah.
I don't know how they do these things anymore. But I think it was Blue Wave that people used to do that. You'd log in, you'd say, these are the sections of discussion I'm interested in.
Yep.
And then and then when you logged in, it would automatically zip up all those files,
mm-hmm.
shoot them to you, and then you'd log off so that the next person... Because I only had two phone lines. One was dedicated to getting stuff in and out from Mother... And the mail server,
mm-hmm.
Father was the file server, and I didn't do many files. I mostly did mail. So mother and I talked every 15 minutes, and that was one dedicated line to Mother. And then because we were on FidoNet, and then the other one was for people to call in. But because they could compress and download, and that only took a few minutes with the astonishingly powerful 386 processor, and eventually, yes, 486 processor,
mm-hmm.
I had in that machine.
And what speed modem?
Started out with a 1200 baud modem, ended up with a 56K modem, 56K BPS modem.
I remember starting out with a 300 baud.
Oh, I personally started out with a 300 baud.
Yep.
The first one was a 150 baud acoustic coupler. But I remember being really angry when I got a 2400 baud modem, because I had written my own terminal program in Forth, and at 2400 baud, I couldn't keep up with the stuff scrolling across the screen, so I had to rewrite the whole thing to save it to disk so that I could look at it later.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Made me angry. Doggone it. This program worked well for months and months and months, and now I had to rewrite it. But yeah, it was those were the days, and now you young whippersnappers with your 100 meg and your gig and all that nonsense, it's my old whippersnapper with 100 meg.
I remember we were we found a guy in Byron that Rochester could call for free, and then he could call Buffalo for free. And so we put a phone, I remember Phil talking about this, we put a phone in his house so that mother could call Buffalo as a local call for free.
Right.
To pass mail down the chain.
Right. All right, we're going to take another quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. Give us a call, 966-5299, 1-800-790-0415. It's 39 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's a truly great and truly grateful to you to be member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Edray.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites.
We should usually there's some Tom Petty in the bumpers in there, and express our condolences to Tom Petty's family who passed away this week.
Yeah. Very
one of the
sad
legends of rock and roll.
Ralphie May passed away this week.
Really? I just saw him on the Magic Show.
Yes, you
he
did.
He was on Penn and Teller.
He was on Penn and Teller. Mm-hmm. But he has passed away. Anyway, here's a piece of news that just will not be... Some people will have schadenfreude about this. Apple seems to have an iPhone 8 battery problem on its hands, and it's not clear yet whether it's occurring in just a handful of edge cases or in a large batch of phones. Over the past week, reports have been coming out about iPhone 8s that have split apart either on arrival or after several days of use. What appears to be happening is that the battery inside the phone is swelling, bending the front of the phones and separating it from the body. So far, there haven't been any fires, just ruined phones. Apple had a short statement on the matter. Quote, "We are aware and looking into it." Unquote. The first report came out of Taiwan, where a woman is said to have found her iPhone swollen apart after plugging it into charge. Someone in Japan then posted pictures of a split-apart phone on Twitter, and in the days since, there have been cases in China, Canada, and Greece. There appear to be only six or so reports so far, certainly less than a dozen that have been publicly identified, so the issue seems to be quite small in comparison to the millions of phones that Apple has likely already sold. In any manufacturing run that big, there are going to be occasional issues. So on some level, seeing a few broken iPhones is expected. But after Samsung's Note 7 fiasco, there's reason to be concerned about what's happening here, especially since it's a battery issue. Batteries shouldn't be swelling in any number, and it's not clear what the half dozen iPhones that are having this problem have in common. While it seems to be rare, there's obviously good reason to want to know what's going on. Swelling is very unusual for a brand new battery and leads toward the direction of there's something fundamentally wrong with this battery, said Sam Jaffe, a battery industry analyst, and not the head doctor in Kildare. He says manufacturers have reached a limit with lithium-ion battery capability and capacity and could end up producing designs with a bigger risk of short-circuiting in an attempt to store more power. For now, he says it's too early to know what's happening with Apple's phones. Could just be random distribution, he said, just a random event, and it's only a few. Jaffe suspects Apple's executives are in crisis mode over the potential damage that battery issues could lead to. But while we've seen a few swollen batteries already, he says it doesn't mean the problem will necessarily elevate into a Note 7-style crisis with phones starting to produce smoke. Swelling is always a precursor when there's a battery fire, but the percentage of actual fires are pretty rare, Jaffe says. In the Galaxy Note case, there were probably a couple hundred battery failures of one sort or another, but there were only a handful of fires, which gives you a sense of the proportion of actual fires. So are you hot to own a new iPhone? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Like I said, it's understandable. Any run of a million, 2 million, 10 million, whatever million phones you have, you're going to have some problems. But it is a battery issue, and that battery isn't made by Apple. We know that, just like it wasn't made by Samsung. But because
actually,
of
it might have been made by Samsung.
Actually, it might have been made by Samsung. But because of the Note 7 fiasco.
And that still was people, only, I think, a couple of phones that were
right,
documented
right.
of having overheated.
Right. But Samsung did the right thing. They ate it. You know, they said, we're taking full responsibility, send them all back, we'll make it right. It'll be interesting to see if Apple decides to do that or if they just slough it off by saying it's only a few.
And it's currently under warranty, so if it does happen, you're going to replace it anyway.
Well, so were the Note 7s, but but people didn't want another Note 7.
Yep.
Well, I got another Note 7, recalled that one and said, you know, no, that one could potentially burn up too, so you got to turn it in.
That's what they're probably working on now. Is this an isolated incident or a complete manufacturing issue?
Right. Mm-hmm. And just as with everybody else, Apple is using cheaper components and building them in many factories. So is it a factory? Is it all the factories? Is it a few components under par because they're getting less expensive components now, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So
trying to cut costs. Well,
yeah,
and
right.
cram more power into a smaller space.
And more power. Mm-hmm. I don't think I had this as a news item. And I know I forgot to send you guys the news this week. I apologize. It's not in here as news. But there's a new battery technology that essentially replaces the stuff between the cells with asphalt.
Well, there's been, so right now it's a liquid electrolyte.
Right.
And so when there's a short circuit in the battery, the liquid boils, produces gas, and that's why it swells.
Right.
So there's been a couple of new technologies coming online. Nova did one on a solid electrolyte, and maybe it's a similar technology to what you saw, where they were showing it, they had a battery plugged into an iPhone, and the guy had a pair of scissors and was literally cutting pieces of the battery off, and it didn't care. It just kept running the iPhone.
Right.
You do that with a current battery, and it will leak and explode and catch fire.
Right. And in this particular case, it's an actual lithium battery that uses an asphalt electrode. And rather than a liquid electrode, it's asphalt. What's nice about it is it holds a higher charge, and it charges in minutes.
And that was one of the other things too. It must be the same technology. The lithium-ion batteries we're using now are using a different technology than the earlier lithium metal batteries did. Lithium metal were much faster to charge and much higher performance, but at a much greater risk of explosion. So generally we don't use lithium metal batteries. And so by this new solid electrolyte, they can go back to lithium metal and get a much higher energy density.
Right. What's interesting is one of the things they talked about is they could charge the battery to full, from empty to full, in 6 minutes and discharge it over 10 hours.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they're also using another battery technology, graphene nanotubes.
Yep. But graphene nanotubes are very expensive.
Yeah.
Asphalt, pretty cheap.
Yeah.
Yep.
So they're very excited about this. It's because it's a solid. It can be handled differently, handled better.
Mm-hmm.
The base metal that they infuse the asphalt with can be mined as well. And they're very excited about this. Batteries, for example, and the energy density is huge. Take for example the batteries that Tesla puts in their cars, they're 250 watt hours per kilogram. These asphalt batteries, 950 watt hours per kilogram.
Whoa.
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're very excited about this technology. It's obviously just starting to be in the lab, right? I mean, they've done a few tests, but not a lot yet. So they're very excited about the idea. They're very excited about the possibility of the technology. And so we'll see where that goes. But That's asphalt. It's obviously slightly modified. I mean, it's basically now the term asphalt, of course, is the stuff you put down in your driveway.
Right.
Right. It's a blacktop.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The tar.
The technical term is it's a viscous semi-liquid hydrocarbon that's just one of the components of paving material.
Mm-hmm.
So asphalt is not really the stuff you put down. Asphalt is a part of the makeup of what you put down.
Well, that's like in that they have commercials where you that spray foam, you know, rubberized. That's a carbon.
Yep.
Because it's flexible in that, and it, you know, like they show, you know, the guy putting a screen door in a boat, and he sits there and sprays it, and that, because that's also got carbon in it.
Yep.
That, you know, it's very durable, strong, and lasts a long time.
Right, and this form of asphalt, which is actually called Gilsonite, is a hydrocarbon, so it has carbon in it,
mm-hmm.
and carbon is the stuff you use to make electrodes in a battery.
Yep.
So it's not as crazy as it sounds.
No.
But, you know, it's
just a new application.
It's a new application for it, and it's pretty good. It's sponge-like, but even more porous than a sponge. For every gram of material, there's actually 3,000 square meters of surface area.
Hmm.
But with all the holes. I mean, it's like a foam. Right, so all those little holes are actually surface area, and they mix in some fabrics of the graphene that you were talking about, some mm-hmm. fragments rather of graphene, that makes it conductive, and bang, the next thing you know, you've got a battery that's like four times more powerful than the current battery in terms of watt hours per kilogram, and charges in 6 minutes. And, you know, it's a 10-hour battery, charges in 6 minutes.
Well,
I don't know how you beat that.
Well, that's one thing I like about my Google phone, the charging system in that. I mean, I could be down to 30%, hook it up to my charger, and within 30 minutes, it's got it back up to 90%.
Yep.
So, you know,
that's 24 minutes longer than this battery, by the way.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? I got to be at my meeting in 10 minutes. Let me charge my phone from zero to full.
Yep.
Yeah, no kidding.
That'd be great.
And because it's like four times more powerful than a regular battery, if you wanted to have the same capacity, you could make it a fourth the size.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so you can have smaller batteries doing essentially the same.
Yeah, but you know what, folks? You know, to be able to just keep it the same size and last that many more days,
right?
But
especially
smaller.
Now with folks streaming stuff and that, you know, these plans are now offering Netflix and everything else on your phone,
right.
And streaming all that eats up battery.
Well,
and smaller applications like watches.
I was just about to say exactly that. Because right now, one of the things that limits what I can do with my watch is how many I can get a day out of my watch. I actually get 3 days out of my watch. But that's because I don't do video on it. I don't do a lot of audio on it. So it'll last for 3 days showing me, well, the time and the temperature and all that other stuff.
I've got mine set so when I'm not, you know, I don't move it. It's dull, but I can still see the time.
Oh, I have mine. Mine's off until I do this, and then I can see the time and everything
mine's
else.
Always
so it lasts about 3 days, and it gets notices from my phone, but that's really all I do. But if I had a battery that lasted four or five times as long, I would do a lot more in my 3 days with that battery, you know, than I do now, and at the same size.
See what I made for my watch. I made a little cradle.
Yeah.
So when I plug in my phone, I set this cradle, the watch on the, you know, the charging unit, and it's just a stand, so the straps lays over it.
Yep.
And I charge up because then this way, because I'm constantly looking at my phone all day while I'm driving and that, you know, and like you say, I get notices in that, and I can, you know, they come right up on my phone.
Yep.
Or my watch, you know, aware of it that it's coming up, so. Phone can be, you know, in my back pocket, and I don't have to worry about it, or I could dictate a text message and reply back.
I had a long text exchange with a friend of mine. I was meeting her for supper. And I texted her and said, I'll be there. And I'm on the way, and I'll be there in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
She said, don't text while driving. I said, I'm not, because I'm doing it with my voice. I'm doing it through my watch. She said, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. She said, no, you're not. I said, can we stop this conversation? I'll show you when I get there. So we're sitting down, and of course, it's harder indoors with the noise in a restaurant and everything else. But I sent her a couple of texts. Now she's looking around for a watch. She's got to have one now.
A lot of new cars now have hands-free texting ties into your phone anyway.
Yeah. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
You can
same
also
technology.
Do it through your phone, but rather than having to take my phone out or have it remember to take it out beforehand, I can just do it right from my watch right here. It's done.
My wife's car has a button on the steering wheel that will start you sending a text.
Yep. Well, that's one thing I like about it at work. You know, I just walk in, they'll be wondering about something, and I just turn my watch. And I go, I'll say okay, and it comes right up there. How'd you do that? And the watch, they go, figures you.
The other thing I like is that my watch will actually do my turn by turn directions. With the thing, so that's nice. All right, listen, you've wasted an hour of your life with this nonsense, and I apologize to each and every one of you that you had to do that. But I know you, and I know that you're not done yet, and luckily for you, neither are we. I'm going to take an opportunity to refill my water bottle because I've been pounding it like a maniac today. But we'll be back in just a few minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and you. You can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free at 1-800-790-0415. And we'll be back in just a few minutes with a whole nother hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe. That's right. I know you're shocked, but this is Soundbites. I'm the truly great and grateful to you that we are indeed member supported. Jazz 90.1. See you in a few.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester. A public service of the Greece Central School District. Jazz 90.1.
On Twitter at 901Jazz.
Welcome back to America's longest running computer show, Sound Bites, on member supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites.
Should say, that voice has been with us for many years.
And yes.
The voice I'm talking about is the none other Harry Legg.
I'm sure that's not his real name.
That is his real name.
Can't be.
Harold Legg. You can go to do a search on Harry Legg.
Harry Legg.
Two Gs.
HarryLegg.com.
L-E-G-G.
Yep.
And Harold Legg. He's been doing our voiceover stuff for this station since I can't remember when we originally started using him. But today is his birthday. So
just happy birthday, dear Harry.
Sending a shout out to my buddy Harry.
And happy birthday to you.
I think,
and many more.
I think I remember his DJ name when he was in town was Scott James.
Yep.
And one of the other DJs said, come on, man, your name is Harry Legg. You got to use Harry Legg.
You got to use it.
Yeah.
And his sister Peg. And
her real name is Linda. Because I actually met the whole family in that. And because they were picking on poor Linda, saying her name was probably really Peg.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, here's the article we've all been waiting for. We knew it was coming. On Thursday, the Wall Street Journal published an incendiary article that says hackers working for the Russian government stole confidential material from a national security agency contractor's home computer after identifying the files through the contractor's use of antivirus software from Moscow-based Kaspersky Lab.
Uh-oh.
The report may well be true, but for now there's no way to independently confirm it. The report is based on unnamed people, the publication said, had knowledge of the matter. This is the Wall Street Journal, but unnamed people, the publication said, had knowledge of the matter, and it provides no evidence to support its claim. What's more, the lack of detail leaves open the possibility that even if Kaspersky's antivirus did help Russia home in on the highly sensitive code and documents, the disclosure was the inadvertent result of a software bug, and no one from Kaspersky Lab cooperated with the attackers in any way. Also lost in the focus on Kaspersky Lab is the startling revelation that yet another NSA insider managed to sneak classified material outside of the NSA's network and put it on an unsecured computer in their own private home. The Wall Street Journal reported that the unnamed contractor removed the material from the NSA and stored it on a home computer that ran a version of Kaspersky AV. The material, according to the unnamed sources, includes details about how the NSA penetrates foreign computer networks, the computer code it uses for such spying, and how it defends networks inside the U.S. Sometime in 2015, the material was stolen by Russian-sponsored hackers who appear to have targeted a contractor after identifying the files through the contractor's use of this Kaspersky AV. The breach was discovered in the first 3 months of 2016. U.S. investigators believe the contractor's use of the software alerted Russian hackers to the presence of files that may have been taken from the NSA. Experts said the software in searching for malicious code may have found samples of it in the data the contractor removed from the NSA. But how the antivirus system made that determination is unclear, such as whether Kaspersky technicians programmed the software to look for specific parameters that indicated NSA material. Also unclear is whether Kaspersky employees alerted the Russian government to the finding. Investigators did determine that, armed with the knowledge that that Kaspersky's software provided, of what files were suspected in the contractor's computer, hackers working for Russia, homed in on the machine and obtained a large amount of information. The report comes as concerns mount inside the U.S. about Russian hacking in general, and more specifically about whether Kaspersky Lab has ever, or might in the future, play a role in supporting such hacks. Rumors have swirled for years that because of Kaspersky Lab's nationality and the early training of founder Eugene Kaspersky, which he received from the Soviet government, the company was a Russian proxy that provided, or at least could provide, when asked, that country's government with assistance in breaking into the computers of Russian adversaries. So do you use Kaspersky? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. It's, I think no matter what happens, Kaspersky's pretty well done.
Yeah, they're toast.
They're toast. It's not going to be good for them.
Guilt by insinuation.
Well, exactly right. Mm-hmm. But that's really all we need in this country anymore. And of course they've had those commercials on the air that, I love the one with the Russian speaking guy who needs a shave saying, "Is your computer infected?" Well, if it is, I'm not going to send it to you.
Yeah,
let's,
really?
Let's be honest right now. That's probably not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. We had a customer come in this morning that got one of those fake messages on his phone.
Oh, yeah.
And so he looked up Google's phone number to call Google to see what to do about his Gmail, and thought he called Google and got someone on the phone saying, "Oh, yeah, it's terrible. Your accounts have been hacked, and all your devices have been hacked. You know, not just that one phone."
Right.
And so the guy said, "Well, can I get like a Yahoo address?" "Oh, no, that would be hacked too." "Really?"
Yeah. Well, Yahoo.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was another one. Yeah.
Yeah. Did admit that this week, all of their accounts have been hacked.
Yeah.
Every single one of the 3 billion accounts have been hacked. 3 billion. If you have a Yahoo account, particularly if you're still using it, you really, really need to change your password right now. And if you use that password on any other system, you'd best change those passwords too and make them different, because we don't know how porous Yahoo is right now.
Mm-hmm. One of the problems is that because Yahoo, so many problems, but one of the problems, because Yahoo is Yahoo Mail is such an old company, and so many people had Yahoo Mail, you may not remember that you had Yahoo Mail, or you used it 10 years ago.
Right.
And it might be the recovery address to your Google Mail.
Right.
Or to your bank account, or to your Amazon account. So it may be fine that your Google account is okay, but someone can send a recovery address to Yahoo because they have the Yahoo password and get your Google password.
Right.
So go into all of your accounts now and make sure your Yahoo address is not one of the recovery addresses in your accounts.
And change your password, at Yahoo.
Different password on every service.
Yep. Yep, it's never use the same password twice, not ever. Because if you use the same password on Yahoo that you used on your bank account, guess what? They have your bank account password.
Mm-hmm.
That's a 100% guarantee because every one of 3 billion Yahoo accounts were compromised. Every single one.
And years ago. And they're finally now admitting that it was all of them.
Right, exactly.
And I can guarantee you half of that 3 billion probably use the same passwords on one as they do the other.
Yep.
Because people, I got to keep it simple. I too many to remember.
I'm too stupid to remember passwords. No, you're not. No, you're really not.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you're right, and people do that all the time, and so it's an issue. And you have to deal with it. And this is another one of those instances where you did nothing wrong. It's not about you. It's about Yahoo. They left their machines open enough that somebody got in and hacked them, and that's not your fault. And you did nothing to cause it, but you're the one who has to deal with the consequences. It's a real problem, and we find it everywhere. So far, the fact that you've got your information, well, look at the Experian hack. The fact that you've got your information out there, whether you want it to be or not, is an issue. But one of the ways you mitigate your risk is to use a different password on every system. Never use the same password twice. Because like I just said, if you used your Yahoo password somewhere else, they now have that password too. And if you are one of those people who can't remember if you use the same password on Yahoo as somewhere else, then you change all your passwords.
Right.
And you don't necessarily have to remember a dozen passwords. You can, even if you don't think you could.
Right.
You can use a password manager like KeePass or OnePass or Apple has their Keychain password manager. And they will suggest passwords when you create an account, 20, 30, 20 or 30 characters long of uppercase and lowercase that you have no hope of remembering, which is good because then you can't be compelled to give them your password. You just have to remember that one password to your password vault and make that a good password that no one could guess.
Right. And remember, the complexity of a password is good. That is to say, numbers, letters, uppercase, lowercase, punctuation. That's good. More important is length, because the longer your password is, the longer it takes to break.
You could have a 30-character password, just letters, all lowercase, and that would be better in strength than 8 characters of uppercase, lowercase symbols and letters.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. There's a thing at GRC called the haystack, and you can put in passwords there and see how long they take to break.
The one other thing, though, that we got to keep encouraging folks to is, whenever you're signing up for an account and that, and you're putting in passwords, they always ask you about various questions, key questions to, know that it's you.
And it always comes down to, if you forget your password, these are things we're going to do.
Now, here's the thing, folks. You know, it's great that you sit there and say, all right, what was your first car? And folks will think, oh, yeah, they remember that. But instead of putting the car make, put the color. It doesn't care.
It doesn't check. I've been saying for years, lie.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You can sit there and say, what car did you have? Black. Or,
you can say, what car did you have the Star Spangled Banner.
Yep.
It does not matter what you put down, and the more you lie, the safer you are.
And you could sit there and say another famous one. What's your mother's maiden name?
Purple.
Yeah. You could do any tree.
Yep.
You know, go
as long as you remember it. And yeah. So if you're using something like NPass or LastPass, you can put all that stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody else, it is not difficult to find my mother's maiden name online.
It's public record anyway. It's on your birth certificate.
Yeah, it's a public record. And so, well, not on mine since they misspelled it. And when I went to get a passport, they had trouble believing I was me because I didn't know my mother's maiden name.
It didn't work, yeah.
I said, look, it's obvious somebody just put a typo in there. They eventually let it through, but they were angry about it.
They misspelled Matthew's name. They only had one T on his birth certificate.
Yep.
I guess too many people are spelling names weird. They didn't think a good old-fashioned name like Matthew had two T's.
But that's a public record. So when somebody asks, what's my mother's maiden name, when that's the security question they want me to answer, I always lie. You know, these are not words I've actually used, but I'll say Chromebook or microphone.
Yeah.
You know, or radio.
Or you use your password generator to generate a 60-character character.
Yeah. The key thing here, folks, is don't go with the standard answers. Like I say, you can find out a lot about information, you know, and, you know, guess, you know, as far as, say, if they ask, what's your first car? You know, they can sit there and guess Chevy, Ford, or whatever. Whereas if you put it in something totally obscure, that is better protection for you.
Or something that has nothing to do with automobiles.
Yeah.
What was your first car? Tree.
Mm-hmm. And again, just keep track of that stuff.
Right.
Any
of the password managers have a plain text field where you can put in all kinds of notes.
Yep.
And that's where you put that stuff.
You can put your three, because usually they want three responses.
Right.
And you can type in all three.
Yep. Type in the questions and type in your answers and everything works.
And it's a way to be in your password secure. Manager.
Because it's in your password vault.
Mm-hmm.
But so you can go to the GRC haystack, and I think Steve's already put up a link to that, type in various words and see, you know, that happy 34 monkey, although that is fairly long for most people, is not as good as 4 score and 7 years ago or
78 billion trillion centuries to breach.
Yeah. Yeah. And except that, of course, it's one of those common phrases that someone will try.
Well, but I checked the other. So Have I Been Pwned is a website that will tell you if your email address has been leaked. They have a companion service that will check your password in the password leak database. So put in an old password you used to see if it's been leaked.
Your Yahoo password.
So I did the 4 score and 7 years ago, and it has not been found in any of the 5 billion leaked passwords yet.
Nice.
Now that I've told them, it might be.
Right, right. We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple minutes, Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Nick Francesco, and you, 19 minutes after the hour. Soundbites, member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we're Soundbites. And we have Tony from Webster on the line. Hiya, Tony. What's up?
Oh, I've got a question for you. A while ago, there was a lot of talk about VPN services that you could subscribe to.
Yep.
And I was wondering, I have an Asus router that has a VPN service that's kind of built into it. And I was wondering, what's the difference between that and the services you subscribe to as far as security goes?
None.
Well,
it depends on where you're. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, so it's likely the router may have a VPN pass through. Or a VPN client. So there's two ends to a VPN. The VPN server you usually subscribe to, the VPN client is built into your routers and built into your computers. So you have to make sure it's actually a VPN server and not just a VPN client.
It does appear to, because they have to go and set up a password and that type of thing. So I was just wondering, what capabilities does it give me as far as compared to a service that you subscribe to?
Well, most of the time when you use a VPN, you don't want people to be able to trace you back. But if your VPN is your router, they can trace you right back to your router. So I'm not sure that that's a useful thing if it is, in fact, a VPN server.
And it depends on what you want to use a VPN for. VPN will encrypt all the data between you and your router. So say you're at a public coffee shop. You don't want to get on the internet at the public Wi-Fi because anyone could sniff what you're doing. So you would use the VPN client on your computer to talk to the VPN server at your house. And then everything you do is encrypted. The other big thing people use VPNs for is to hide where they physically are. So you subscribe to a VPN service that comes out in, say, Dallas, and anyone who's looking at your traffic thinks you're in Dallas. And so you can hide your physical location as whether as the in addition to the contents of your traffic.
Okay.
So the VPN server built into your router would be fine for hiding the contents of your data, but not for hiding your physical location.
Right.
Okay. Now that I'm more confused.
Well, here's the idea. When you use a VPN, there are two ends. The client end, which is your computer, and the server end. Now, what happens is all the data between you and the server, the client and the server, are encrypted and kind of tunnel through the internet, so theoretically, it's hard for anyone to know it's there and break into it.
Okay,
that makes sense. From the VPN to the rest of the world, it's open.
Okay.
Right? So, it has to be, because nobody else knows the special secret protocol you're using. As Steve said, if you were in a coffee shop if this is in fact a server, where it would be most useful is if you were in a coffee shop and you could set up your operating system so the VPN use that VPN, then you've got your own built-in VPN server and everything that between you and the server is encrypted, but of course it's unencrypted from there on. The real beauty of that is if you use an outside service, you're essentially using that outside service in place of your router, which means it's the server, which means all of your data hits it and is then decrypted and sent on, which means you better trust that VPN. Because you don't know if it's a third party, you don't know if they're saving all the data that you're sending out. So you use them to securely do your banking, but they're now stealing your username and password at the VPN. Having that VPN on your own router means that there's nobody else looking at those data.
Okay.
Did that make you more confused?
Well, yes and no.
Yeah.
I'll have to go and look through the paperwork. The documentation came with the router. It's kind of cryptic. It doesn't explain exactly what they're doing. It tells how to set it up, but not exactly what they're exactly doing. So I'll have to do my research.
Yeah, right. You do have to. You really want to read the manual and see what kind you've got and how it works.
Yep.
VPNs are common for corporate business users. You want to work from home but still be connected to your your business network. So the VPN does that. The other big thing VPNs are used for is to steal content on the internet because then they can't find where you are.
Right, and a very tiny minority of people use it just to be really secure on the internet.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of VPNs out there. Again, it's a game of who do you trust? Which VPN do you go with that you absolutely trust? For example, Opera has a built-in VPN, which is a beautiful thing, except that VPN is in Canada.
They're so darn polite, though. If there was a problem, they'd apologize.
That's exactly right. The big thing is that you just don't know who's at the other end.
Right.
Unless you really know the company. I don't know anybody at Opera. I don't know what they do. I don't know how they do it. So using them as a VPN, not necessarily a good idea. Now,
that's the advantage of having your own VPN is you control it at both ends, and so you trust yourself usually.
Yep. And back in the day when I was working at RIT, I had a server that I used, and I set up my own VPN on it. So there I was. I mean, people would know I was coming from RIT, but they wouldn't know from where in RIT. And because it was my server, I knew exactly what was in and out of that server at all times. And so it didn't matter to me that I was using a proxy, because I trusted, well, myself in that particular case. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thank you. Thank you, Tony. Bye-bye. I do love the idea of a VPN, but the devil is in the details.
Yep.
And it really does depend on who you trust.
There's a number of companies out there, yeah.
Yeah. Who's the host of Who Do You Trust? Jan, it'll come to me later. About 3 a.m, I'll call you all up. but basically, who do you trust? And so you have, I beg your pardon, and so you have a decision to make every time you use an outside VPN.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, like we said, using your VPN, if it's internal to your network, then the only people you're keeping information from is the other people in your network. And in fact, if you were doing things you didn't want your spouse or your children to know, that's useful.
True. Private mode is in your browser is usually better for that.
Well, it doesn't necessarily encrypt data on the network itself. So if your kids are savvy enough to sniff the network and you really want to keep things private.
There's no technology a 12-year-old boy can't bypass.
Exactly. God, that is so very true. So true.
Yeah. Well, it shouldn't be sexist these days, and a 12-year-old girl could probably do it too.
That was about to say, it's not just the boys.
Yeah. Person.
Right. So there's a beauty and a simplicity, an ease of use to VPNs, but there's also that question of who, in fact, is at the other end, and is anybody listening? Now, lots and lots of VPNs say they have no logs. They do not log VPN data, traffic. They do not log it. And that's great, but I don't know how you verify that without a nice little road trip to the VPN headquarters and letting them look and them letting you look through their code.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's likely not going to happen. But having a VPN, like I said, Opera, for example, the web browser Opera has a built-in VPN. And as long as you trust the Opera company and those wily Canadians who run it, you can use you can use it with impunity, I guess. But like I said, if you can set your own VPN up on the internet, it doesn't necessarily protect you from people knowing where you are, but it actually protects your data until you get to the VPN. And then from the VPN outward, of course, it's unencrypted again. Bless you. But Steve is apparently allergic to VPNs.
He's having a VPN attack.
So that, you know, people can still sniff it once it gets out past the VPN. But at that point, they will not know it's coming to or from you. Which is really the important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't care if they know that somebody on the internet is doing X.
Yeah.
Because that's a given at any day or hour.
Yeah.
But you don't want them to know it's you.
Right.
And that's the idea behind
it. And like you were
VPN.
Saying, you could sit there and point it towards somewhere out of Texas or wherever. Even another country.
Right.
And route it. So, you know, that way you're not being traced.
Right. I like
one we can't say on the air just because of its name.
Oh yeah.
so they've become known as HMA. Hide my
donkey.
Yeah. That's their logo too.
It's their logo. It's a donkey. but so basically there are a lot of them. Some charge, some are free. The free ones are usually slow. They will slow down your internet stuff because they have a lot of the public ones, particularly the ones that are free, have an awful lot of traffic on them. So no matter how fast that machine is, it's getting bogged down.
Right.
That's clearly going to happen. But a private one will cost you money, but is often much faster.
Of course, if you had green light in the neighborhood.
Well, that has nothing to do with VPNs.
Yeah, but it'd be faster.
Along the way, yeah.
It would certainly be a lot faster if you had green light in your neighborhood. Hey! I wasn't the first person to get green light in my neighborhood. I was the second. Because my next door neighbor owned the pole, and his deal was, you can use my pole. It's on my property, but you can. He had to sign something.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'll sign this if I get it first. And they said, yeah, you're like 30 feet away from the pole. It's really not an issue for us. And then I was second.
Well, I found out, yeah, it's in the neighborhood, you know, in that area.
Yeah.
But like I say, the folk, they're already right across the street from me, already at 50%.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Across the street.
Just so you basically
dig a trench.
Right, dig a trench. So you basically could throw a stone, and no matter which direction you throw it in, you could hit a green lighthouse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't be laughing.
No.
But it's funny. No, apparently it's not funny.
What's a little annoying is that there are other fiber companies in town, but they are generally marketing themselves toward business customers.
Right.
And one of our clients had one of the other fiber companies, and they were paying three times more than Greenlight for a tenth the speed.
And yep.
Why? So
because they could charge that.
They could, yeah.
Well, you know, one other thing, I don't know what's going on in the city, and it's all around. There's, and you see it on the expressway. These companies are sitting there, and they're putting these cables down. They've got to be about 2 inches in diameter, and they're laying four of them, and they're digging a trench,
yep.
And they're spreading these wires all over the place. I don't know whether it's some new type of fiber optics or what.
I think they're standard fiber optic cables.
It just depends on whether it's
I say they are
television
yeah,
or internet.
That's the size fiber backbones are, because they've got hundreds of fibers in them. Half of them are dark and half of them are light.
Well,
and
they're putting down four different colored big all along the expressway and around connecting. I'd love to know if anybody knows what the heck that's for or who's doing it. Because I also noticed they're also updating the signs along the roadside.
Yeah.
You know, the warning signs and all that. They're updating those. So, you know, I don't know whether it's for local internet or whatever it is. But if anybody does know, it'd be
so
interesting.
So apparently Monroe County has a fiber optic network that's 367 miles long.
Yep.
And so it's probably the county that's putting the fiber in. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is an old story. So, I hate when they don't put the data at the top. So, the county does have fiber. I know Frontier, the local telephone company, has fiber. But when you go to buy internet services from them, it's business price. And that's the annoying thing, too. It's business pricing.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I remember in the basement of the other only public radio station in Rochester had a bit of there's a roll of fiber loop of fiber that followed the inner loop.
Yep.
Of course, now that half the inner loop got dug up, I don't know what happened to that. But there was a loop of fiber that followed the inner loop, and it came out in the basement of that studio.
You can still get around pretty good. It's still with what's left of the inner loop.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that. I'm just wondering if somebody broke through the loop at some point in digging something up.
They could have.
All right, we're going to take another break. Back in just a couple of minutes, Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 39 minutes after the hour. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. And we'll be back with a whole lot more of the longest running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites on the truly great and solely member supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest running computer show. Back to more soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. I have another Apple story. This is actually a semi-good one. Maybe even a whole good one. On Wednesday, Apple released a software update for its Series 3 watches that will upgrade Watch OS 4 to Watch OS 4.0.1. This is the first update to Watch OS 4 since it became available for all Apple Watch models on September 19th. So what, 3 weeks? 2 weeks? The Watch OS 4.0.1 update focuses on fixing a particular Wi-Fi issue some Series 3 with LTE models experience. The issue prevented the devices from connecting to LTE in favor of connecting to an inaccessible but familiar Wi-Fi network. The update page details the problem. Watch OS 4.0.1 fixes issues that in rare cases were causing Apple Watch to join unauthenticated or captive Wi-Fi networks, such as those found in public places like coffee shops and hotels, which direct the user to a web page before the network can be accessed. I hate those. I hate them with a passion. In the first round of Apple Watch Series 3 reviews, some reviewers experienced this problem. The Series 3 attempted to connect to a Wi-Fi network the user previously approved and connected to via another Apple device like an iPhone or a Mac. The public Wi-Fi networks often make users accept terms and conditions or input temporary passwords before connecting. Since the Apple Watch cannot display these options, the Series 3 would appear to be connected to a Wi-Fi network even though no service came through. This prevented the Series 3 from connecting to LTE services in areas where the users may have wanted to use cellular data over any Wi-Fi network. Apple knew of this Wi-Fi network problem soon after the review process and said it was looking into a fix that would come as a software update. Watch OS 4.0.1 is that update and is only available for Series 3 watches. Is only available for Series 3 watches. No software updates are available for any Series 2 watch. Watch OS 4.0.1 is ready for download to any Series 3 device. To download Watch OS 4.0.1, go to the Watch app on your iDevice and navigate to General, then Software Update. Your Apple Watch Series 3 must be connected to Wi-Fi, placed on its charger, and have at least 50% battery life to download Watch OS 4.0.1. So do you own an Apple Watch? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
There have been two patches for iOS 11 that came out, and it's up to 11.02 now. But no patches for macOS 10.13 yet. We generally recommend people wait for the first patch before you upgrade, unless you like living on the bleeding edge. before you upgrade, check your applications. I had a customer this week that they upgraded it and five of their applications don't work.
Yep.
Well, check that before you upgrade so that you don't have a nasty surprise like this.
Yep. My Chromebook updated this morning. I always check it on Saturday mornings while I'm eating breakfast. I set it up and see if it'll update, and lo, it did today. And when it came back up, it was all different.
That's the other thing people hate. Everything looks different.
Well, everything looks the same now that I've logged in, but the login was different. I have it set for smart lock, which means if my phone is unlocked and it's in proximity to my phone, then this is unlocked. My Chromebook is unlocked. So I don't have to type in the password.
Right.
Only with this particular update, it came up and said you have to type in your password this time, and then next time it'll do that.
Yeah. Yeah, my Mac does that with the fingerprint. Every now and then you still have to type your password in.
Right.
So I just had to do that so somebody didn't cut your finger off and is using that.
Right. And in fact, it didn't throw me off. And in fact, it's not really different at all. But I could just imagine people going, oh my God, this is completely different.
Yep.
What happened? Well, read the screen and it will tell you that. Again, one of the things I most love about the Chromebook is it updates in the background.
We've got.
Does it automatically?
Automatically, yeah. We've got a security camera software that that we sell and use. And if you use the app, the border is green. If you use the website, the border is blue. And we've got people that cannot use the website because it looks completely different.
Mm-hmm.
It looks exactly the same to me.
Except for blue and green.
Right. So, obviously, that's a programming shortcut or shortfall. They didn't use the same color. So, the guy that wrote the app is different from the guy that wrote the web page.
Right. Well, and I've seen that. I wrote some code for some people, and they complained that that one of the arrows wasn't obvious enough. So I made it red. I immediately started getting phone calls. What the hell changed?
Everything's
nothing.
Different.
And I actually said nothing. Yeah, that's not the same. What did you change? And I thought, I didn't change that. Oh yeah, the dark blue arrow is now bright red. So it actually stands out, and people who apparently never saw the arrow before
all of a sudden take notice.
Now see it, but they're now confused.
And that's everything changed.
Mm-hmm. Literally, the only thing on the entire website that changed was the dark blue, and that's the original color they wanted, but they said, well, we'd rather have it red. Okay, I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
That was a real easy fix, frankly. The dark blue arrow is now bright red, and it made everything different.
Of course.
I can't use it anymore. Put it back to the way it was.
Yeah. Just think if I had, changed the color behind it, the background color, to the arrow, made that, yellow.
You want to turn them into Tailspin.
Holy moly. Where am I? I'm in the wrong place.
Oh.
I'm on the wrong page.
Well, it's just because they see that one change, and they assume...
Right.
Everything else has changed.
Well, and that's just it. Most people, it's a subliminal thing.
Mm-hmm.
Most people probably, apparently, never actually saw the arrow because they had a color scheme they wanted to keep, but people weren't seeing the arrow. Okay, I completely get that, and I, in fact, told them, I don't think people are going to notice this arrow, but okay. But now the arrow is bright red. People notice it, but subconsciously something has changed, something they look at every day.
Mm-hmm.
Is different. Now they have to step back, and they're suddenly seeing elements on the screen they've never really looked at.
Isn't that weird? That happens a lot.
Yeah.
I see people go through menus. You know, I say, had a customer the other day, how do I print? You go to the file menu and choose print. Which one's the file menu? The one that says file.
The one that says file?
And so I see them moving back and forth across all the menu bars, skipping right over file. No, okay, second one over, file. Okay, got it. Then they'll go up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. Don't see the print.
Yeah.
They just skip right past it.
Yep.
Slow down a little bit. Read each line.
I was showing somebody, what was it? Oh, it was this. It was Google Docs. And in the upper right-hand corner... you have your name, right? Your email address, and you can pull that down and go to account. And they couldn't figure out what it was they were supposed to click on. And then somebody said, "How did you know that was there?" And I said, "Well, there's a little down arrow right next to it." There's a what? there's a down arrow.
That has meant there's a menu here since.
Since about 1530.
Since GUIs began.
Well, and then I just noticed, and I don't know how long this has been going on, I completely admit, I just noticed on the Google search page, in the upper left, there's an about and a store that I just don't remember ever seeing before yesterday, or earlier this week. And so, of course, I then spent time playing around with those. Do you have... A lava lamp on your
I have a lava lamp on my dashboard.
Very nice.
And annoyingly, it doesn't work as fast as a computer. It's a lava lamp, so it takes 20 minutes to get going.
Yep.
Seriously?
Yeah.
For it to heat up and like the old days.
I still have a real lava lamp, and I'm kind of afraid to plug it in.
It is 78 days until Christmas.
Shut up. Shut the hell up. Shut up now. I do. I have a real lava lamp, and I am afraid to plug it in. Because it is from the 60s.
Yeah.
I have had this thing since, late 60s, early
70s. Yeah.
And I just don't remember. But there's now an about and a store on the Google homepage that I did not notice until yesterday. And I wondered how long those have been there. And so I went and I searched through it. That seems to be news stuff.
Yeah, where's the Wayback Machine? Let's find out.
Right. And then there's all the Google Store.
And interestingly, I'm on a Mac with Safari, and it still gives it to me.
Yes.
Now, if you hit Store, does it take you to the Play Store or the Google Store?
No, it takes you to the same place. This is the Google Store.
The Google Store, made by Google.
Yeah, I have to hit the actual Play Store button to go to the...
Yeah, they also came out with a mini home that looks like the Echo Dot, and then a maxi home that looks like a Sonos Play 3.
Yep. Yep, the Google Home Max has many big speakers in it.
Yep.
And the Google Home Mini is the same kind of tiny speaker that's in the Echo Dot. But, you know, Google Home only had one device, and it was more expensive than the Dot. So a lot of people were buying the Dot. And I get that. Well, that's that. I must say, we've come together to the end of our time together this week. And I want to thank everybody who called in. I want to thank Dave Enright, and I want to thank Steve Ray, but I really shouldn't. I'm Francesco, and don't go away, because George is coming in to play the best German music you will hear all week. Michael's here to keep him on the straight and narrow, so there's really nothing to be afraid of. And we will be back next week with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. You know what I'm talking about. It's Sound Bites, and it's right here on the Truly Great and Truly Grateful to You that we are member-supported Jazz 90.1. Be good to each other, and we will see you in just 166 hours.